bringing you the latest in tax credit news, insight, and analysis. This is Tax Credit Tuesday with your host, Michael Novogratz.
Hello, I'm Michael Novogratz, and this is Tax Credit Tuesday. This is the March 5th, 2024 podcast. As those of you watching on YouTube can see, I'm joined by my partner, Tony Capone, and Novogratz Director of Public Policy and Government Relations, Peter Lawrence. If you work in renewable energy tax credit financing or development, you've come to the right place, because Tony and Peter are joining me for today for another installment in our renewable energy tax credit finance series. This is a series that we launched last year to help you stay abreast of renewable energy tax credit financing news, trends, and strategies. And today, we're doing a roundup of hot topics in renewable energy tax legislation and regulations. Now, there are several important changes and potential changes on the horizon that you, as a renewable energy professional, will want to watch closely. And today's your lucky day because we have planned a hot topic roundup. Today's podcast is going to focus on four key topics that we want you to be aware of. The four topics we're going to cover are: one, the $78 billion tax bill that's currently under consideration by the Senate; two, the Basel III proposed final rule; three, investment tax credit proposed regulations as they relate to investment tax credits on renewable energy and energy storage; and then fourth, domestic content guidance. By the way, today's discussion is meant to be a high-level overview of these topics. We do get into much more detail in our renewable energy working group calls. If you're not already a working group member, I welcome you to join us. In those working group calls, you not only stay updated about important legislative and policy issues that can and most likely will affect your business, but you also have a chance to provide feedback that we in turn share with Treasury, the IRS, and other regulatory agencies as to guidance and proposed guidance and desired needs. Both Tony and Peter, no surprise to you, I'm sure, are leaders of the Renewable Energy Working Group. I'm very excited for them to share with you some of their insights on today's topics. We do have a lot to cover. So if you're ready, let's get started. So Tony and Peter, welcome back to Tax Credit Tuesday.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you, Mike.
You've both been on many times before, but I do like to start with a super brief introduction. And since you've both been on before, I'll ask you to be very brief. I'll start with you, Tony. If you would just want to say a few words about the services you provide to Novogratz clients, then I'll turn it over to Peter.
Sure. Thanks, Mike. So at Novogratz, I had the pleasure of overseeing three different kind of divisions of services for the firm. I've got one group that specializes in what I call transaction advisory services. That's where we help clients structure deals, run financial models, and those kind of related services. I've got another group I oversee that specializes in providing financial statement audit services, and then a third group that specializes in providing tax return services. And I work across all the firm's different tax credit industries, but obviously have a very concentrated effort in the renewable energy sector.
Great. Thank you, Tony. Peter.
Yes, I am the Novogratz Director of Public Policy and Government Relations. And as such, I focus on federal policies that affect our main tax credit practice areas, such as affordable housing, community development, historic preservation, and of course, renewable energy, as relevant for this week's podcast. And as such, I work primarily with Congress and the federal agencies like Treasury and DOE on these efforts.
Great. Thank you for that, Peter. Thank you again, Tony. So of the four topics, I want to start with the tax bill that's on front of mind of many people. So this legislation was agreed to by the heads of the Congressional Tax Writing Committees in the House. That would be the Ways and Means Committee and Chairman Jason Smith. And in the Senate, that would be Finance Committee Chair Ron Wyden. Now, the tax bill has passed the Ways and Means Committee by a vote of 40-3 and then was overwhelmingly approved by the House by a vote of 357-7.
If I could just interrupt you there, Mike, just for a second. Yes. That is a very unusual vote in Congress these days. There's not much that gets that type of vote. So that was a really super impressive vote. I just wanted to interject with that.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. It was a needed two-thirds majority, which was 289 plus or minus, and obviously greatly exceeded the two-thirds majority.
84%. Yeah.
I think you've done that calculation and showed that calculation before.
Mm-hmm.
So the bill now is awaiting Senate consideration. Now, many people know that the bill does include major provisions for the long-term tax credit, but the bill also has important implications for the renewable energy community. Peter, if you could share some of the main provisions of the tax bill that pertain to renewable energy investments, that would be great.
Sure, happy to. So I'm going to start with bonus depreciation, which, Mike, as you point out, is sort of a bit of a misnomer, given that it's not a bonus necessarily. It's just that you're able to expense property life that has 15 years or less. This is something that was originally provided for in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act back in 2017. And it began to phase down starting last year, actually. Instead of 100% expensing, you could only expense 80%. And so this legislation that's pending in the Senate, if it were to be enacted, would reinstate the ability to exercise 100% expensing for that property life that's 15 years or less. So obviously this would have a beneficial impact for renewable energy investments. The legislation, in addition to reinstating it for last year, would also extend it through 2025, which would line up the provision with many things that expire in 2025. Next year is going to be, as I think you've mentioned in previous podcasts and columns, Mike, a really big year for tax legislation. And Congress is really trying to sort of set the stage for that with this legislation, and bonus depreciation sort of fell in with that general theme. And so, sort of, again, just to reiterate, for 2023, for 2024, and 2025, instead of the phase down that's currently in law, it would be restored to 100% for those years. In 2026, however, current law would remain, when you'd have a sharp drop from 100% to 20% as per the original phase down schedule. So that's one particular provision of interest. The other one we'd like to highlight is the amount that taxpayers can deduct, amount of debt they can deduct from their taxes. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017 set a limit on that of generally a 30%. And the formula that is used to determine that amount is earnings before taxes, depreciation, and amortization. That changed last year to drop off the depreciation and amortization components. This legislation would restore that. Again, you'll notice the theme here for 23, 24, and 25. And so to the extent that you use debt financing for your renewable energy investments, that could be beneficial to have. So we're hopeful that this legislation will move forward, but I'll pause in case you have anything to add on that point.
Yeah, I just wanted to note or emphasize, I should say, that it is retroactive to 2023. So as we're working on tax returns, as 20 is working on tax returns, that you could, if you file them now, you have that, you have a 80% expensing. But if you wait and the bill does get enacted, it would be 100%. And I also want to emphasize what you also mentioned was in 2026, it drops from 100% to 20%. So to do projections now, if you're placing the property in service at the end of 25 versus early 26, there's a notable difference in the depreciation that you can project now if this legislation is enacted. I also wanted Tony just to weigh in on kind of roughly what percentage of renewable energy investors do you think avail themselves of bonus depreciation versus not? Just, I know it's hard to say what that percentage is, but it's not 100%.
Right. Opt it. Yeah, right. It's not 100%. And I'd say some investors will opt for bonus depreciation on some deals and then not necessarily avail themselves of it on other transactions. I think the significant aspect here, though, is if you look at renewable energy facilities, it's not uncommon for at least 80 to 90%, maybe even more than that, of the property to be bonus eligible. So it really is a significant portion of your depreciable basis is eligible for bonus depreciation. And so if you're an investor that's really sensitive to your after-tax IRR, then being able to get those accelerated deductions is a real difference maker. So yeah, so in my experience, investors, it's on a case-by-case basis in terms of whether or not they go for the bonus depreciation, but it's certainly a valuable incentive especially from a time value money standpoint. As far as the debt goes, on renewable energy, you don't see debt financing in renewable energy project finance like you do in, say, real estate. Okay, so it's a smaller percentage of the overall marketplace that gets financed with debt. And probably when you do see it, it's probably fair to say that those transactions are your smaller deals. And then even when you see debt on a renewable energy project, the debt may only make up, you know, 40 to 60% of the total capital needs. So again, if you're just trying to analogize renewable energy project finance to real estate, fewer projects are financed with debt and renewable energy. And the ones that are, it's probably a smaller percentage of the overall project costs that are using debt. So the interest deduction is probably not quite as meaningful. I mean, if I were to talk to my investors that count on that, they'd probably argue with me that it's still a difference maker. But if you're just trying to compare it to, say, the depreciation deductions, the bonus depreciation is obviously, it can be a bit of a game changer in terms of after-tax IRR.
I can hear those emails coming to you now.
Exactly. It doesn't matter.
Exactly. So, but the bonus depreciation is a real difference maker for sure.
And just to clarify for our listeners, in terms of the interest expense limitation, there's generally a 30% limitation deducting interest expense against the income of a business. Up until last year, you could add back depreciation amortization, or said differently, it was the income before depreciation amortization, which generally speaking, it's going to be positive, such that 30% of that was your limit. Starting last year, you have to reduce it by depreciation and amortization, which then for many businesses, going to cause you to have a taxable loss, in which case you wouldn't be able to deduct any interest. And that's an issue sort of at play here. And I would note that in real estate businesses, you can elect to extend their residential rental life from 27 and a half years to 30, and then the rules don't apply. So that's how it generally gets dealt with in the locus and test credit area, which is not what this podcast is about. But for those that are listening and want to have a bigger view of how this plays in community development space, I thought I'd share that. So Peter, now let's talk about what people really want to know once they know the provisions are in there and they're supporting them, is they want to know what the likelihood of the passage. And maybe the level set for our listeners. Congress members did return to Washington last week after a 2-week break, and they did come back just in time to vote on a deal to avoid a government shutdown. And whenever I say that, I always have to follow it up by saying, at least for now. It was another reprieve with an extension of existing funding deadlines, which were extensions of prior funding deadlines or extensions of prior funding deadlines. And I'm not quite sure how many times they've been extended. You might know offhand, Peter, but I know it's been several times since last year. And the new extended funding deadlines are March 8th, so later this week, and then March 22nd. So it's March 8th and March 22nd as the new extended funding deadlines. So with that as sort of the backdrop, because obviously Congress has to be very focused on those two matters, either fund by those dates or extend them again. With that as a backdrop, Peter, please share with our listeners, what are some of the ways in which this tax bill would make its way through the Senate, potentially be voted on again by the House to become enacted as law?
Yeah, happy to do that, Mike. And I guess I would like to just emphasize a point here. I wish I could give you a date certain here.
As do I. I wish you could do that too.
I really do. I really want to. I want to be able to do that. But unfortunately, I think with anything in Congress these days, you can't do that. As your comment about how many times we've gone through this rodeo on extending the federal government funding, the federal fiscal year started on October 1st, and here we are. It's March, and we still don't have a permanent plan yet, although that might change for some parts of the federal government. This week, as you pointed out, the first sort of minibuses, they're calling it, 6 out of the 12 annual spending bills might be packaged together and considered by the House and Senate this week, and at least give certainty to those federal agencies in advance of the Friday deadline. But there's still uncertainty for those other 6 with the deadline there coming up on March 22nd. But just you mentioned one of the ways this tax bill can go forward. And basically, they're really essentially, you know, 3 main pathways. And I guess I'll start in order of least likely to most likely. The first option would be the schoolhouse rock option of legislation has passed the House. So then it gets taken up by the relevant committee, and you have a what's called a committee markup, where the relevant Senate committee would consider legislation. That would be the Senate Finance Committee. And I would say this is the least likely, because it would further delay. There's a lot of time and preparation associated with markups. You have both chair and the ranking member have to agree on the scope and all. It's just, it's a very involved process, and time is not this tax bill's friend. And so I don't think, it's certainly a possibility and it certainly could happen, but it seems to me the least likely option, especially when you consider with a tax bill, you have a markup, you could have all sorts of changes which may change the calculus of the bill being passed. So I think that doesn't seem likely. The next likely scenario would be the Senate to take the bill on its own, right directly on the Senate floor. A lot of legislation that's passed by the House is sometimes considered by the Senate this way, and certainly is a possible pathway. But I guess one of the reasons why I would think this might not happen is tax bills have big scope associated with them, and therefore can attract all sorts of amendments. And I kid you not, Mike, you might see a situation where 1,000 amendments are filed. And when you have that situation, unless both Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell can agree on how many amendments, a time, otherwise it could take several weeks to get through the Senate, that one single bill. And so that's why I think that's also not the most likely circumstance. I'd say the most likely circumstance, and the reason why I talked about the spending bills, is that we've often seen tax bills are added to a spending bill that is viewed as a must-pass piece of legislation. And so there's that second so-called minibus with a deadline of March 22nd. Of course, that deadline can be extended yet further, as you point out, Mike, but at least that is an action-forcing event. Unless Congress passes something before that date, those agencies have to shut down that are funded by those bills. So I would say either in advance of that deadline or along with whatever Congress finally decides for those six annual spending bills, I could see that as probably the most likely way this tax bill advanced. And I think one of the new sort of deadline that Senate Finance Committee Chair Ron Wyden has said in the past is the filing period on April 15th. So we'll see if that prediction holds up.
Yeah, and I think you read the same stories I've read, how even that, some have suggested, is a hard and fast deadline. I will note, and maybe you could comment on the fact that from a spending perspective, April 30th probably is a bit of a more significant hard and fast deadline for the spending to have to happen, which if this ends up being attached to spending, then that becomes maybe more of the hard and fast deadline. And maybe you could share with our listeners the magic of April 30th.
Yes, yes. It's not something that you normally think of. It's something that as part of the debt limit deal last year, remember that, Mike?
Yes, I didn't know.
There was a provision inserted as part of the agreement to raise the debt limit to say that any continuing resolution that is still in effect from January 1st onward, if Congress has not implemented final legislation by April 30th, the spending is subject to a 1% across the board cut. Now, you may think, well, 1% doesn't sound too much, but it's actually based on the fiscal year 2023 budget, because a continuing resolution essentially is just continuing the previous year's spending levels for a certain time period. And so considering that the federal budget generally grows with the economy, that's actually a much larger cut. And when you can also consider the uncertain situation in the world right now, where there's all these demands on the Defense Department for a variety of things, as well as other federal agencies, I think that deadline gives a little bit more cogency for Congress. I think that they will be motivated to try to avoid those cross-the-board cuts.
Great. Thank you for that. Now let's turn to our second topic, Basel III. So we're turning to regulatory updates. Boswell 3, for our listeners, is another installment in the periodic update of internationally agreed to regulatory standards for banks. So here in the U.S., the three banking regulatory agencies this past fall issued a notice of proposed rulemaking to finalize Basel III rules here domestically in the U.S. And the proposed changes would increase the large bank capital requirements by 400%, or really increase it by 300%, from 100% to 400% for non-community development equity investments that are not publicly traded. So that's non-community development equity investments that are not publicly traded. That is a bit confusing. And you probably know why we're talking about it here, because this is the category that would include equity investments in renewable energy tax credits. So Peter, please explain for our listeners how this proposed final rule on Basel III could affect renewable energy tax credit investments. I do suspect that most listeners are thinking, let's see, 100% risk weighting to 400% risk weighting, that's probably not good.
No, indeed. Okay. And I want to hasten to add, I don't think the federal bank regulators were necessarily trying to target renewable energy here. One thing just to keep in mind, these bank capital guidelines were initially sort of triggered by the 2008-2009 financial crisis. So it's taken a while to develop, and it's been sort of under gestation for a long, long time period. I think this is often the case of the left hand of the administration not knowing what the right hand is doing. And they've heard from a lot of stakeholders about the potential impact of the Basel III large bank capital requirements regulations. If they were to be finalized, it would be pretty devastating to renewable energy and devastating to the administration's climate change goals, which are very much predicated on lots of new renewable energy equity investments. But just to, again, reiterate what you pointed out, Mike, that the proposed regulations do change the risk weighting for renewable energy equity investments from 100% to 400%. And that really would have a dramatic impact on the appetite of banks to invest in renewable energy. And they are a very important source of investment for renewable energy. And members of Congress have written to the federal bank agencies, and many, many, including the major renewable energy trade groups, wrote in response to the public comment request that was due on January 16th. And right now, the federal agencies are digesting those comments. And we've heard some sort of general comments from John Podesta, who is sort of the White House coordinator of the various climate change and renewable energy implementation, as well as the federal bank regulators, about the need to account for the impact of these proposed regulations on renewable energy. We don't have a clear sense yet how soon those regulations will be finalized. It's possible the administration could repropose them with a totally new set of proposed regulations, have another comment period. So it's not clear yet, but I will say the Biden administration is also aware of the later we get into 2024, the more vulnerable any final regulations might be in a new administration. And so they do want to leave a legacy of regulations that last. And so I imagine they'll want to try to avoid that potential by finalizing long sooner rather than later.
Great. Thank you for that, Peter. And I'll just add a question that isn't something we're going to answer on this podcast. That's something maybe the topic of a future podcast. And that is, depending on how these rules shake out, this could end up leading banks to want to purchase tax credits and the transfer provisions as opposed to investments in partnerships. And that's a big topic to unpack. So we'll have, maybe if depending on how all this transpires, we might have to get Tony back to talk about some of the tax structuring aspects of that and how developers of tax credit properties can be maximizing scenario sort of develops. Hopefully banking regulators find a way to carve out renewable energy tax credit investments, or at least lower the risk weighting below 4% back to where it was, but at least have it not be as bad as it's proposed to be.
Right. And if I could just add what I'm seeing in the marketplace so far here is that, as you guys know, the PTC is a tax credit claimed over a 10-year period, as opposed to the ITC, which is claimed in the year the facility is placed in service. And what we're already seeing bank investors who would be impacted by these heavier sort of weighting guidelines, as we're seeing bank investors already kind of dial back from commitments on PTC transactions. And so you're already seeing a noticeable impact on the industry. And so we're obviously, clients, investors, et cetera, we're all kind of hoping that bank regulators can hopefully remedy this situation as soon as possible, because it's already impacting the amount of investments being made into renewable energy.
And just to maybe unpack that a little bit, you can comment, Tony, or fill in the blanks. When you talk about PTC, acronym check, production tax credit.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I think we all know ITC is the best of tax credit, but the fact that the production tax credit's out over 10 years, banks investing in production tax credit transactions, actually thinking about potential for these higher capital charges out for a long period of time. Conversely, if you're looking at an investment tax credit opportunity, the property is going to be placed in service more quickly. And as a consequence, you quite possibly would have the property in service, claim the credit and the rest before these rules kicked in. And if they did kick in before that, it wouldn't be a long period of time, whereas 10 years would be a long period of time to be taking into account these higher capital charges. So how did I do?
You did fantastic. You get an A, A plus.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, right. So, the investment holding period for the PTC is at least twice as long as what you'd find on an ITC deal.
Right.
So
now let's look at the third topic that I had, and what couldn't be more fun than talking about proposed tax regulations. So proposed tax regulations came out for renewable energy and energy storage investment tax credits. So Tony, what are some of the main aspects of those proposed regulations that you think it's important to share with our listeners here today?
Great. Thanks, Mike. So before I get into those comments, I just want to point out that the firm helps lead, as you mentioned earlier, Mike, the Renewable Energy Working Group, which is a working group comprised of industry stakeholders made up of accountants from Novogratz & Company, as well as developers, lenders, investors, advisors, and so forth. And so one of the things that our Renewable Energy Working Group does is we sort of read through IRS guidance and we respond to comment requests from the IRS and Treasury on these various forms of guidance. The IRS and Treasury released new guidance in the form of proposed regulations on different aspects of how you interpret the rules for claiming the investment tax credit on energy property. And some of the key aspects there, one of the key provisions there is with respect to biogas property. One of the provisions basically excludes the cost of cleaning and conditioning equipment on biogas property, which is something that they don't provide a similar type of carve out on other types of energy properties. And so if you're working on a biogas property, you should be aware of this because it has a significant impact and a reduction to your eligible basis. So one thing that we did in our comment letter is we obviously went back to Treasury and the IRS and we requested that they reconsider that sort of different treatment for biogas property. And we basically asked the IRS and Treasury to put biogas property on a level playing field with the other technologies. Another aspect of the proposed regulations that I want to draw people's attention to is that there's another provision that disqualifies the ITC for projects where functionally interdependent components are owned by unrelated taxpayers. Now, this is something that comes up often for geothermal heat pump properties. On geothermal heat pump properties, you can have certain components that are underground, owned by one taxpayer, but those facilities also incorporate other functionally interdependent components that are above ground and oftentimes owned by the building owner. Okay. And what the IRS is saying here in these proposed regulations is if those two taxpayers are unrelated and you've got components of one facility, some components owned by one taxpayer and other components owned by a different taxpayer, then nobody can claim the tax credit. And we think that and our Renewable Energy Working Group members agree that that provision unfairly targets and hurts the geothermal heat pump industry. So in our comment letter, we asked that the IRS and Treasury reconsider that provision so that geothermal heat pumps aren't put at a significant disadvantage. Another aspect of the proposed regulations, again, staying with functionally interdependent property, is around there's a provision that seems to allow some technologies more favorable treatment than other technologies. An example I'll give you is with respect to batteries. The proposed regulations seem to suggest that when you place in service a battery, that after the date you place it in service, you might be able to incorporate other types of components to improve the efficiency. For example, with battery technology, there's a lot of concerns around power degradation. And so a lot of people think that with battery properties that you need to add certain battery modules over the life of the facility so to prevent excessive degradation. And so the proposed regulations seem to suggest that in those later years, as you place in service other battery modules, that those battery module can also you qualify for the tax credit. However, the proposed regulations generally say that if you're going to be eligible for the tax credit, then all functionally interdependent components have to be placed in service contemporaneously or meet what's referred to as the 80-20 rule, which means you have to kind of retrofit the whole entire project. Again, this seems like an area of the guidance where it seems like certain technologies are benefiting more than others. And so sort of a theme to our comment letter is just try to make sure all technologies are on more or less the same playing field. And lastly, another aspect of the regs that I want to highlight has to do with the definition of what's called a unit of property. Usually a unit of property means certain components where when you put them all together, they can sort of function independently, okay? And in the proposed regulations, it appears there's two different definitions for unit of property. There's one definition of unit of property, which is used in the adder for environmental justice, the environmental justice adder. And that's sort of a facts and circumstances based definition. And then there's a separate definition for unit of property, which is used for the other adders for the prevailing wage and apprenticeship adder, domestic content, and the energy community adders. And again, one of the things that our renewable energy working group letter asked for is to have one definition for the unit of property, and we sort of favor the definition, the facts and circumstances analysis found with the environmental justice adder. So those are the key highlights within the proposed regs. I think functional interdependency is sort of the big theme there that industry stakeholders are focused on. And really what we're asking for, again, is just more consistency across various technologies.
Thank you for that, Tony. That's very thorough, and I will include a link to the Rural Energy Working Comment Letters to the show notes today. And speaking of the Rural Energy Working Group, Novogratz partner Nat Ng was at the Treasury hearing last week in Washington to testify on behalf of the Novogratz Rural Energy Working Group about its recommendations with respect to these regulations. So what were some of the takeaways from the hearing itself that you might want to share with the audience?
Great. Thanks, Mike. Yeah, so my partner's Nat Ng, and he also was benefited by Alvin Lee. They both were able to kind of participate in the hearings last week. And my take from talking to Nat and Alvin is that it was extremely well attended. And in particular, the biogas community showed up in great numbers. Because I feel like if you read through those proposed regulations, the one technology that sort of, I guess, was heard or perceived to be hurt the most from the proposed regulations was the biogas community. And so they showed up in strong numbers. It was a six-hour meeting. You had about 30 different industry stakeholders that attended the hearings. And the themes discussed were largely consistent with the items that I highlighted previously in my comments.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
So let's move to our fourth. And that's the domestic content guidance. So Tony, if you could explain to our audience first what domestic content guidance means. It's something that in the real energy space is a classic situation where we all talk about domestic content guidance and all the rest. And I've spoken at conferences talking about it and someone will raise their hand and say, what do you mean domestic content? And shame on me because I get caught up in all this. At least I didn't use an acronym. But if you can explain what we mean by domestic content and then what the latest news is.
Sure, sure. So domestic content, you know, if you build a renewable energy facility and it qualifies for what's referred to as domestic content, then you're eligible for an adder, an increased tax credit amount, if you meet the domestic content criteria. Domestic content means you're essentially using components and materials that are sourced here in the United States. And so the IRS basically requires that a minimum percentage of the components that go into the plant are sourced right here in the United States. And it's an extremely complicated area of guidance to sort through and understand. But big picture, it requires 100% of iron and steel to be sourced in the United States, and then at least 40% of any quote unquote manufactured products be sourced in the United States. And by that, it means 40% of manufactured products, it's basically all the components that are in that manufactured product, at least 40% of them come from the United States. Now, that area, taxpayers, we've tried to work with a number of different clients to sort of satisfy that domestic content criteria. One of the services that Novogratic offers is called the Agreed Upon Procedure Services. That's a classic service that investors and developers seek from a firm like Novogratic to sort of meet certain tests like the domestic content criteria. And so we've gone through this exercise a number of different times with clients, and it's been trying to apply that very complicated area of guidance to specific transactions has been very tricky. And we've done a pretty good job at that. At this point, we have successfully worked on a number of these different transactions. So if you're trying to work through this analysis, I definitely encourage you to reach out to us, because I think we've made as much progress on this front as anybody. But anyway, one of the key aspects of the domestic content guidance that's problematic has to do with how you do that 40% calculation when you've got a manufactured product that's comprised of components that are sourced here in the States, as well as some components that are sourced outside of the United States. And the requirement is that if you've got a component that's from outside the United States, that foreign supplier has to exclude their margin from the numerator in that calculation. And you can only imagine how difficult it is to try to get, you know, any kind of supplier to divulge their profit margin, never mind a foreign supplier. So trying to get that transparency for the manufactured product calculation has been extremely difficult. And then once you kind of work through that analysis, it can oftentimes, once you exclude that margin, you can oftentimes fail that sort of manufactured product test. Another aspect of that analysis that's difficult is that if you look at the way the calculation is done, you exclude their margin from the numerator, but you include their margin in the denominator, which makes the calculation the test that much harder to satisfy. So one of the things that we've asked for in our domestic content letter to the IRS and Treasury, we asked that both the numerator, to be consistent, basically, if you're excluding the margin from the numerator, you should also exclude it from the denominator. So we'll see there. As a matter of fact, we actually expect new guidance from domestic content probably within the next month or two, I think. Peter, I don't know how that compares to your expectations on domestic content guidance, but...
Well, that was the original idea, and Treasury Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy, Lula Batchelder, said that this was part of the next batch they're planning. However, we have heard recently that they've been a little bit slower than expected. So I don't know if we're going to meet that deadline anymore. We had thought first quarter of 2024 was the target time period, but now it does seem like it's going to slip to April, May, unfortunately, as much as how key and important that guidance is. And it is one of the biggest areas that Treasury IRS hasn't yet produced true regulatory guidance. They've been some sub-regulatory guidance notice, but there's a lot of still important details that need to be filled out. And that 40% threshold is scheduled to go up over time, right, Tony? So it's really these details will be more and more important as the years go on to get it right, to be in a practical application. I mean, I think everyone understands the general policy for wanting to do more manufactured components here in this to insource many of the elements of the renewable energy industry here. Getting those details right is very, very, very important. And there are some other resources coming online, like the Section 45X Advanced Manufacturing Production Tax Credit, which is designed to help foster that industry here. But it's that's going to take time as well to develop.
Oh, I'll also just point out on that, on the domestic content criteria, if you're looking to qualify for elective pay, or commonly referred to as direct pay, so that's the incentive that tax exempts sort of seek out here under the IRA. If your project's over a megawatt or meet other criteria, you need to meet domestic content in order to even qualify for the, call it the 30% incentive. So if for elective pay, if you do not meet domestic content for projects where you start construction after 2023, then your tax credit is actually reduced. So it's not even just that you meet domestic content and get the adder, but if you're trying to qualify for elective pay, in order to even hit 30%, at least that, you also need to meet domestic content criteria. There's a few exceptions there, but if you're a nonprofit or an otherwise eligible elective pay taxpayer, you should definitely pay attention to the domestic content criteria. Because if you don't meet domestic content, you wouldn't even get the 30% ITC.
And you said, appreciate you pointing that out, Tony. That's pretty important for those. And you said reduced.
Yeah, I don't have the thresholds memorized off the top of my head, right. But you wouldn't even, like, let's say you otherwise would qualify for the 30% ITC. But if you don't meet domestic content, you wouldn't even get the 30% ITC.
Right.
And this is just for elective pay. It doesn't apply to the ITC under 48. It's elective pay. And again, elective pay is for nonprofits, tax exempts, and other applicable entities, but it's not for typical taxpayers looking to claim the ITC. So I don't want to.
Right. Understood. So thank you both. Let me give you one last chance. Is there any concluding thoughts that you want to share with our listeners? We covered a lot, and I know we could talk for hours. Any parting comments from you, Peter, first, and then Tony?
No, I want to encourage folks, you really, the bonus appreciation and the 163J limit on deducting debt is important to you. Please reach out to your member of Congress, especially your senator, to say, this is really important. You should act to advance this legislation. That advocacy is really important if we're going to encourage the Senate to act. The more they hear from stakeholders, especially if you're a constituent, the more likely we'll have that bill advanced. So, and if you have any questions about how best to do that, please feel free to reach out to us.
Yeah, thank you for that, Peter. I'm definitely really optimistic. The bill will ultimately be enacted, but failure remains an option. So I'd encourage listeners as well to reach out. The more listeners that reach out to their senators, the likelihood is that it ends up getting enacted. Tony?
I'll just point out that I will be speaking at SEIA's Finance and Tax Seminar this week in New York. And so if you're attending that event, I look forward to seeing you there. And then next week, my partners, Nat Ang, Josh Morris, and I will be at InfoCast in Phoenix. And so if you're attending either of those events, I'd love to meet you in person.
Great. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Peter. Please do stick around for our off-mic section. And as our regular listeners know, that's where I usually ask my guests for some fun off-topic advice or recommendations. But this time, our off-mic section is going to have a bit of a twist, so please stay tuned, listeners. And also to our listeners, I will share Tony and Peter's contact information in today's show notes, so you can contact them directly with any questions that you have or observations. Also, so that you can reach out about joining the Renewable Energy Working Group. And as I mentioned earlier, I will include in the show notes a link to some of the Renewable Energy Working Group's comment letters, as well as links to previous episodes in our Renewable Energy Tax Credit Finance series. And also, I want to let you know, or to our listeners, that we have a dedicated playlist or a YouTube channel with all of our episodes in this series. So be sure to check out that series. Feel free to binge watch on YouTube, and I'd encourage that to share it with others on your Renewable Energy Finance teams. So now, let's turn to our off-mic section. And as I alluded to earlier, regular listeners of the podcast know that I usually use this off-mic section as an opportunity to ask my guests to share some off-topic tips and recommendations with our listeners on a variety of areas. But in one of the more recent episodes with Tony as my guest, he wanted to share an industry shout out. And I really love the idea of industry shout outs. So I invited Tony and Peter to do the same thing today. So Tony, I'll start with you since you're an old pro at this shout out
concept.
And Peter can just sit there and wonder, is he going to shout out the same person or entity or group as me? Please share a shout out, Tony.
All right, great. So in this week's shout out, I want to mention a good friend of mine and industry colleague, Chris Diaz, who is the co-CEO of Seminole Financial Services. And so Chris, I've known Chris Diaz since way back in the 1990s when we were both working in the low-income housing tax credit industry. Chris used to be an executive with Midland, who, Mike, you might remember Midland.
I do.
Right? And so back Midland used to syndicate low-income housing tax credit investments. Eventually, they started the Seminole Financial Services, and they started getting into renewable energy. Now, Midland was a client of mine in the low-income housing tax credit industry days. So I knew Chris way back then in the 90s when we both worked on low-income housing tax credit transactions. When they created Seminole Financial Services and they first started getting into renewable energy, he heard I was also trying to start a renewable energy practice here at the firm. And I was one of the first people that he called as he was trying to start his business. He flew to Boston. We got together at 101 Arch Street in Boston, which is where Novogratz's office was, same building where Boston Financial was located for years. And we would talk about just different ways we could sort of grow our renewable energy business, how we could work together, how we could collaborate. And that led to just a long relationship of just working together on different transactions. And he's been a great friend of the industry and mine and so many others. So just want to give a big shout out to Chris Diaz.
Well, thank you. I'll echo that shout out to Chris Diaz.
Thank you.
So my industry shout out will be, I guess, I would like to mention a couple things. One, we work very closely with CEO of the Solar Energy Industries Association on a lot of it, policy issues. We are very much congruent with them on many, many regulatory priorities as well as legislative priorities. And I want to just mention in particular two folks who we've worked with, and that is Ben Norse, who's been the sort of CS point person on implementing the Inflation Reduction Act, as well as Jeremy Woodrum, who is a frequent speaker at our renewable energy conferences and has been the CS one of key congressional relations staff. So I want to give out a shout out to both Ben and Jerry.
Excellent. I love it. And so Peter, STIA is hosting their finance and tax seminar in New York City this week. So I look forward to seeing Ben and Jeremy at that event. And I'm speaking on a panel with Chris Diaz at that conference.
There you go. All three.
It is a small world.
Indeed.
So, thank you for that. And I want to give a big shout out to Ben Norris and Jeremy Woodrum as well. Jeremy and I have been on lots of renewable energy sessions at the Novogratz conferences. So give Jeremy my best as well, Tony.
Will do.
Likewise.
Well, absolutely. Thank you both. And to our listeners, I'm Mike Novogratz. Thanks for listening.
This weekly podcast has been brought to you by Novogratz & Company, LLP. Archived podcasts are available online at www.novoco.com/podcast or by subscribing to the Tax Credit Tuesday podcast in iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Radio Public. You can find related links referenced in this podcast on our website at www.novoco.com/podcast. Novogratz & Company, LLP is a national certified public accounting and consulting firm with offices nationwide. Learn more about our professional services at www.novoco.com.